Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are endlessly challenged to understand adequately what is going on with respect to a particularly important front in that war for the free world, namely Asia. And a man who has made it his life's work, really, to penetrate what has been concealed from us, to assess what is known, to second-guess some of the predictions and prognostications of others, is our first guest. He is Dr. Larry Wurtzel, a man who has served for many years in a number of important capacities, including as the chairman of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. He has also been a senior executive at the Heritage Foundation, where he ran its Asian Studies Center. He had a 32-year career in the United States Army, from which he retired with distinction as a colonel. Having served much of his career in the Far East, he was also a ranger as well as a member of the Airborne. Larry Wurtzel, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Frank.
Good. I want to sort of start with, I think, the thesis of your relatively recent book, The Dragon Extends Its Reach, Chinese Military Power Goes Global. We had Michael Pillsbury on recently with a new book he's got out called The 100-Year Marathon, which suggests that China is really now moving into a new, although long-planned, stage that is going to be far more threatening to us. Do you concur with that assessment?
I do. I think that Mike did a great job with that book. I've only read reviews so far. I've got it on order, but the snow's keeping it out of my house. In any case, I think he's absolutely right that the party, the Communist Party leadership, for about a 15-year period has laid down some stiff challenges to the PLA to be able to protect distant sea lines communication, and particularly to be able to conduct expeditionary warfare in addition to their regular roles. And it is a long-term thing. Interestingly, when Mike Pillsbury was interviewed by Bill Gertz on this RAND report that you want to talk about, Mike's comments were that when he was interviewing people in China, he found that the PLA officers were somewhat challenged by the party's layout of future missions, by the ambitious programs set out by party leaders. And I think that's accurate.
You know, what's interesting about this is that we've for some time been told that the party may be undergoing internal turmoil, certainly the economy is, and that the rise of the military is somehow something that's taking place apart from and in some ways maybe perhaps even despite the attitudes of the Chinese party leadership. Xi Jinping is, as you know, Larry Wurtzel, so well, consolidating power. How do you characterize his relationship with the People's Liberation Army? Is he its master, or is he dependent upon it for support inside the party?
Well, I think it's a little of both, but he's clearly very, very comfortable with being the chairman of the Central Military Commission. He worked for Gung Biao. Gung Biao was the head of the military and the minister of defense, the chairman of their general staff department, the equivalent of their joint chiefs of staff back in the 70s and 80s. And Gung Biao picked out Xi Jinping as his military assistant. And Xi, who had never served in the military, put on a military uniform, went to work every day, interacted with the general staff of the military, interacted on a regular basis with Deng Xiaoping. He's just really comfortable in that role, and I don't think since Deng Xiaoping there has been a Communist Party chairman that has as comfortable in his relationship with the military.
Michael put it, I think, interestingly. He said, you know, there isn't a hawks versus dove split at the moment in Beijing. There's a hawks versus the super hawks. And that's an ominous sign, especially against the backdrop, Larry Wurzel, as you and the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission have done such extraordinary work documenting. We're witnessing a buildup really across the board of Chinese power projection capabilities, asymmetric warfare threats, some of them enabled and certainly made far less costly through their cyber espionage against us. But I do want to turn to the study that the U.S.-China Commission requested of the RAND Corporation, because it has gotten some press and it seems to be suggesting, or at least it's being interpreted as suggesting, that while there may be these kinds of challenges coming from China, they have many sort of inherent weaknesses as well that can be exploited and that will offset for quite some time to come their rising power. Give us your read on this report and its findings, Larry Wurzel.
I'm pretty happy with the report. Of course, I know and have worked with virtually all of the authors. I think they're really good people. RAND, we put out a request for proposal for this on the commission while I was on it, and RAND had far and above the best proposal with the best people working on it. And it's not far off what I say in my own book, The Dragon Extends Its Reach. Now, first of all, from an institutional standpoint, the People's Liberation Army knows it has a personnel quality problem, and it does, partly because of the way it recruits, partly because it's not the most professional bunch because of cronyism in the party, and partly because of promotion. When you promote the people that are able to pay the biggest bribes, you're not always getting the best leaders. Yeah. Second, there are some areas where the PLA really does lack combat capacity. Their ability to conduct strategic airlift is limited. They're working on it. They understand that. Their fleet air defense capabilities are weak, and some of their anti-submarine warfare. The biggest area, I think, is that the future missions that both Hu Jintao, with his historic mission speech in 2004, and Xi Jinping, with his China Dream speech laid out for the PLA, are real challenges. Sea lines communication protection involves the ability to get expeditionary naval task forces out from China's periphery and support them with combat logistics. They can do it in a very limited way.
But Larry, let me just ask you, this seems to me to be something that is kind of inevitable if you don't have those assets with which to, you know, get experience. They haven't been in, you know, long-range warfare for, well, I guess at all for since the Second World War. But what they are building unmistakably, as you've documented in your book, The Dragon Extends Its Reach, and others have, is capacity in these areas.
They are training. There are really major exercises inside China that integrate their forces. They ran an air deployment across Iran into Turkey to do an air war game with our NATO ally, the Turks.
Before we run out of time, just very quickly, I get that this is, you know, something they are working on. Do you think that we should, on the basis of the RAND study or otherwise, let down such guard as we have up at the moment with respect to China? And more to the point, shouldn't we be heightening our presence in and ability to contend with this rising Chinese capability?
Frank, you're exactly right. The RAND study means that we should refocus our efforts to ensure that the restrictions placed on U.S. military cooperation with China in the 2000 National Defense Authorization Act continues. We don't want to do anything to help them become a greater threat.
Larry Wurzel, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we've got to get you back on for a longer chat about all of this, if you'll indulge us. Larry, thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform, including as an assistant army attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and your time with military intelligence, as well as, of course, your time at the Heritage Foundation and most recently at the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Please check out Larry's many books, including most recently The Dragon Extends Its Reach, Chinese Military Power Goes Global. Next up, J. Christian Adams joins us. We'll talk with him about Hawaii and what the Chinese may have in mind there. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by J. Christian Adams, a particularly courageous former career attorney in the Department of Justice, who turned, in a manner of speaking, state's evidence against what he found to be, well, injustice. In fact, that's the title of his book, Injustice: Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. And I wanted to talk with him about a couple of elements of that program. And first, let me just say, Christian, it is always a delight to have you with us. I know when we tried to last week, you were unwell. Glad you're back on your feet, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You called to my attention something that I think fits the profile of the racial agenda of the Obama administration, but with enormous strategic implications. Talk a little bit about what is going on in Hawaii at the moment.
Well, what's going on in Hawaii is that there is a separatist movement, an anti-American separatist movement that over the course of the last 20 years has actually captured a number of important political victories, thankfully to be put down by the Supreme Court of the United States. But this is a growing native movement, and the Obama administration is actually considering granting by fiat, by edict, rather than by law, status to this separatist nativist movement. This is called a Hawaiian sovereignty movement. You may remember an Akaka bill is what they called it over the last couple of years that would do this by force of law. It never would pass Congress. So Obama is planning on doing it. And lo and behold, we discover ties between this Hawaiian native separatist movement and Red China, which really should come as no surprise to anybody who's been paying attention to the Pacific. Notably on your show, we've talked about Guam many times.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, a similar play has been underway, as you have been warning about, in Guam. We talked in the previous segment, of course, with Larry Wurtzel, who reinforced our reasons to be concerned about what the Chinese are up to. But talk a little bit about how this might translate. Were the separatists to have their way, were the Obama administration evidently to have its way as well, and for sure the Chinese to have theirs in terms of this incredibly important state of this country, but also the strategic assets, most especially military and intelligence, that are out there?
Well, of course, in the short run, it all may look benign and simply as a sort of a racial giveaway. The separatist movement would be granted power over certain land areas, native Hawaiian holdings, things that go back to before the queen was deposed in the late 1800s. It would vest in this racial subgroup a variety of powers to manage their affairs, which they do not currently possess. And it looks benign in the short run, but of course, this isn't really about the short run. This is about the long run. And while the Obama administration might grant these racially discriminatory powers to this entity, the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, in the end, it's about prying loose Hawaii from the orbit of the United States. That's what the Hawaiian separatist state specifically they want to do. So it's not sort of a club of people who go down to the Italian-American club and have a beer and eat spaghetti. This is a genuine movement to make Hawaii something different. And of course, that has strategic implications because of Pearl Harbor. And just like it has strategic implications in Guam.
It does. In both cases, the similar kind of impulses seem at work, namely to really do violence to the national security interests of the United States. However, as you say, Christian Adams, benign it may appear at the outset, that's the end state. And in some cases, I think it's true in both Guam and here, the prime movers behind this are pretty explicit about their purposes. But you've raised a couple of points that I just want to touch on quickly. As a lawyer with a considerable record of distinguished service in the Department of Justice, I know you've been very troubled by what the president has been doing by fiat lately, notably in connection with the immigration action, his executive amnesty, as it's been called. And I want to come to that in a moment. But before we get to it, just staying with this sort of race baiting or race divisiveness, if you wish to give it the most benign treatment, what are we to make of the role that Eric Holder, your former boss, has been playing in Ferguson, Missouri, for example? And that's really a microcosm, as your writings at PJ Media and elsewhere have made clear. And what should we expect from his successor if Loretta Lynch were to be confirmed?
Well, you need to understand Holder through a racial lens, because he looks at everything through a racial lens. He has said so. He carries around in his wallet a quote that says his blackness defines him more than anything else. And what you're seeing in Ferguson is an ongoing effort to divide the country. People might say, well, what good does it do Eric Holder to divide the country? Well, it does do them good. It does do their movement good. It creates polarized voting, racially polarized voting, where you have cohesion coefficients. You have statistical block voting around 95%. And that helps the Democrat Party to have racial blocks. And here's the other important fact, Frank. The left thinks that the American demographics are going to be different in 50 years. They'll say it openly. It's not hard to find that it's going to become a black-brown coalition majority in this country. And if you can have racially polarized division among African Americans and Hispanics, you create this impenetrable political block if, in fact, the country's demographics change, which they all say it's going to.
Yeah, well, they're working hard at it, aren't they? And that brings me to the last point with you, J. Christian Adams. Again, he is the founder and guiding force behind the Election Law Center. You can also read his writings at PJ Media. Talk, if you would, about this ruling by a federal judge in Texas. Has it provided real relief? What's your reading of it in terms of this demographic agenda of the administration and their determination, notwithstanding the absence of congressional approval, to proceed?
Well, look, it's good that it happened. It lays down a marker for the narrative that this abuse of power is taking place. But understand something. It's of limited value. For one, DOJ is going to go berserk trying to get it reversed on appeal. And secondly, how do you command 6,000 federal bureaucrats to start enforcing the law? I mean, who is going to peer into their computers and their docket sheets to see if they're actually enforcing the law? I think it's a good thing, but I don't think the courts have the power in the end, in reality, to enforce force people to follow the law. I think that it's up to Congress to defund, to restrain, to fire if necessary, to do RIFs, reductions in forces, to eliminate positions of the people who don't enforce the law. So it's good that this ruling came down, but I think it's going to be of limited utility.
Should we be hoping and urging the Senate of the United States not to confirm Loretta Lynch as a woman who's made it pretty clear she intends to enforce this unconstitutional action of the president's?
Yeah, I think the Senate has to extract concessions from the administration in exchange for confirming Lynch. It has to get Lynch to break from Holder. And unfortunately, Lynch has not done so. There's no daylight from those hearings. There's no daylight between Lynch's policies and Holder's policies. They are the same person as far as policy. They might be different in temperament. She might not be so arrogant and lack Holder's, Holder has no self-awareness about how belligerent and brazenly lawless he is. But Lynch still shares the same policies as Eric Holder, and that's why the Senate Republicans have got to extract concessions that she will either break from those policies or not be confirmed.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. We, as always, appreciate your insights and the clarity with which you express them. J. Christian Adams of the Election Law Center and PJ Media. Please check out his book if you haven't already committed it to memory, Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department. We will be staying on this case in Hawaii, as I know will you, and we look forward to talking with you about it in the near future. Next up, Rosemary Jenks joins us. We'll drill down on this immigration issue and other developments straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The backdrop for today's White House Countering Violent Extremism Summit will be the latest outrage by the Islamic State, its mass immolation of 45 captured Kurdish soldiers. Like his previous claims to have put al-Qaeda on the path to defeat, any assertion by President Obama that he is successfully countering such, to use his phrase, violent extremism, should be seen for what it is, a fraud perpetrated on the American people. As you listen to news accounts of actual or pledged progress at Team Obama's international summit, keep this in mind. The number, reach, and ambitions of global jihadists today constitute vastly more serious problems for peace and freedom-loving peoples than was the case 6 years ago. If allowed to continue unchecked, they will imperil our children and grandchildren. Some legacy, Mr. President. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined once again by a favorite of ours here at Secure Freedom Radio, and indeed a great and much admired colleague, Rosemary Jenks. She is the director of an absolutely incalculably important organization in Washington and across the country. It's called Numbers USA. The fact that there has not been comprehensive immigration deform and all manner of other affronts to our laws and national interests to date is in no small measure a product of Rosemary's leadership and the fantastically important work of the members of Numbers USA across the country. Rosemary, it's always a delight to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Well, we were just talking with Christian Adams about this ruling by a federal judge that has, for the moment at least, it seems, caused a bit of an interruption in the president's headlong pursuit through executive action of amnesty and all manner of other concessions on immigration. Do you think it represents, well, as they say, a stay of execution, you being a quite accomplished lawyer, or is it perhaps the beginning of a commutation of sentence?
Well, you know, it's a very good sign, and Judge Hannon laid out his arguments very carefully, very thoughtfully, knowing that the decision would be challenged. The problem is, of course, that the appellate court can overturn or stay the injunction at any point. So, you know, this makes it even more critical that Congress actually take steps to defund the president's unconstitutional amnesty. And that is, of course, what the House of Representatives has voted to do on the DHS funding bill. And it is what the Senate Democrats are filibustering, preventing it even from coming to the Senate floor, which is pretty amazing considering that it funds the entire Department of Homeland Security except for the unlawful activities of the president's orders.
Yeah, this brings up the old hoary notion that there's a government shutdown in the offing. First of all, what would be shut down? And if it were in any way, shape, or form to translate into a shutdown, who would, in fact, be responsible?
Well, what happened the last time the government shut down at DHS is that about 30,000 of the 230,000 employees did not come to work. Most of those are administrative staff. So virtually all, 85%, 86% of DHS employees are considered essential workers, so they would have to continue coming to work in a so-called shutdown. Now, I think it should be obvious to most Americans that if the Senate Democrats are filibustering the DHS funding bill and preventing it from coming to the Senate floor for a vote, that would mean that the Senate Democrats are the ones responsible for shutting down DHS if it happens. The House has passed a full funding bill, $40 billion. The Senate Democrats are blocking it. It should be fairly clear.
Yeah, and Rosemary, I have to say, the Republicans in the House, including the leadership, seem to be fairly robustly standing behind this idea of defunding these examples of executive overreach, unconstitutional behavior. Where are they, in fact, as you see it, and where do you think their Senate counterparts are?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Republican leadership in the House has been standing firm and speaking out and saying, you know, we did our job. We passed a bill that funds the entire Department of Homeland Security except for the illegal unconstitutional amnesty. We cannot fund an illegal act. The Senate Republican leadership has been a little bit wishy-washy, not too surprisingly, but they have essentially been forced into a position where they have no other choice, because if the House, you know, under the Constitution, all appropriations bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. So the Senate can't just pull up its own bill and decide to go in a different way. It has to address this through a House-passed bill. If the House refuses to pass a different bill, the Senate has no choice but to take up the bill that the House passed.
Unless they do nothing, in which case there is this impact on some 30,000 people. But they have to, in some way, shape, or form, before too long, Rosemary Jenks, put funding into the rest of that that department, right?
Yes. Well, and, you know, this was the whole plan that was laid out by Republican leadership in both chambers back in November when they did the Cromnibus. You know, they passed an omnibus spending bill with every other executive branch agency except for with DHS. They did a short-term continuing resolution so that they could have this fight this year when the Republicans held the majority in the Senate. They did this all on purpose. You know, and now they're realizing in the Senate, oh, hey, wait a minute, maybe we didn't think this out all the way. But you know, one way or another, they're going to have to figure out a way to get over this impasse. And it needs to be that Senate Democrats are pressured enough to allow the House passed bill to come to the floor for a vote. They can amend it all they want, but they need to allow it to come to the floor for a vote.
I'm so delighted that you're keeping the pressure on them at Numbers USA, Rosemary Jenks. And we saw in some hearings last week that your team has reported on that there's a growing awareness, really, that this situation demands the sort of action that the House has required, and I just pray the Senate will find a way to get that done. Let me turn to another issue that I know you've been tracking as well, and that is a vehicle for the legal introduction into this country of large numbers of people who may actually be very problematic, particularly from a national security point of view. Talk about the Refugee Resettlement Program, how it operates, who benefits from it, and specifically, who seems to be in the pipeline to come here in large numbers that could be, as I say, really quite a problem for us?
Well, the refugee system has become essentially an industry of its own. Refugee contractors, essentially, you know, supposedly charitable organizations that are actually funded almost entirely by the federal government, by taxpayer dollars, are paid by the head to resettle refugees in the United States. The UN actually selects who those refugees are that we will be taking here. And then these groups are paid by the head to resettle them across America. The contractors decide which towns the refugees will be resettled in, and they send large numbers to each town so that they will have their own little refugee community. And then they essentially abandon the refugees, most of whom, you know, don't speak English, they don't have job skills, they're essentially just found housing and then left. And they go on welfare immediately. They're entitled to every welfare program that the United States offers on day one. The big problem we have right now is that the UN wants us to take tens of thousands of Syrian refugees who have been displaced by the conflict in Syria, and we don't have any way to vet them. We don't have any information on who they are other than what the UN tells us, which is based on what the individual refugees have said. So, you know, we know that ISIS has said that they are infiltrating the refugee camps in and outside of Syria. So we know that they're placing terrorists into the refugee camps, and we don't have the means to vet them. So, you know, the FBI has said that they're very, very concerned about the potential dangers in us resettling these folks into the United States because we have no idea who they are.
This is a huge problem on so many levels. The idea that we've relinquished our sovereignty to the United Nations, which is largely driven these days by something called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, as you know, Rosemary Jenks, and they have an agenda of using, a process that's known as al-Hijra to sort of colonize non-Muslim lands like ours with people who seek, whether it's the violent kind of jihad of the Islamic State or the pre-violent, as I call it, of the Muslim Brotherhood, it's a problem, needless to say. And again, your efforts to help us all understand the magnitude of these changes that are taking place under our noses at taxpayer expense with this cottage industry sort of self-dealing and benefiting from it are tremendously appreciated, as are, of course, the great work that you've been doing on the executive amnesty. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope that you will keep us apprised of what is happening and most especially what the Senate of the United States is going to do about the idea of stripping out this important set of prohibitions that had been passed by the House when they return from recess next week. Rosemary Jenks of Numbers USA, again, thank you so much for your leadership and your joining us today. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West. We'll get her take on some of the same kind of subversion in the context, particularly, of the Countering Violent Extremism Summit right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
President Obama is holding a Countering Violent Extremism Summit this week. But he can't seem to figure out why these extremists are so violent.
ISIL is not Islamic.
Violent, vicious zealots. Who behead people or randomly shoot a bunch of folks in a deli in Paris.
There is a consistent thread that links together ISIS and Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah and Boko Haram and the Taliban. And it is not simply some abstract violent extremism. It is radical Islam.
The groups the president has chosen to work with appear to be more of the problem than the solution. Boston is supposed to be one of his models for success, yet the Islamic Society of Boston and the Muslim American Society there are riddled with extremists.
If anything, we are less capable today of describing our enemies because they have managed to infiltrate our elites, they've managed to infiltrate our universities, they've managed to infiltrate our State Department, they've managed to infiltrate our think tanks, and increasingly the armed services.
If the president really wants to counter violent extremists, he could start by keeping them out of his Countering Violent Extremism program.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress.
A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not. It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Diana West is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, as she is each week. Diana is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a blogger par excellence. You can find her work at dianawest.net. Please check out her two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
Well, it was great to have you with us as well for the Defeat Jihad Summit that we convened last week on Capitol Hill in anticipation of the summit that the president's having today, as a matter of fact, as we speak. I want to get to that in a moment, but maybe first of all, sort of you have been writing on your blog about some of the takeaways from the summit. Give a sense of what you took away.
Well, I took away, I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to get a lot of the practitioners and thinkers and politicians together to try to confront this problem that's been with us now, 15 years, really, at the center of our concentration. I do detect still some of the same disagreements or perhaps strategies that I think are retarding our abilities to really defend ourselves and our Constitution. And this really comes down to how we talk about Islam. And what I tried to speak about and what I've written about since in a piece called Notes from the Defeat Jihad Summit is the notion that when we talk about Islamism or Islamic extremism or radical Islam, and the left talks about violent extremism, the subject that is missing is Islam. And I think it's very important to focus us back on Islam because the central control mechanism of Islam is slander law. Slander law prohibits discussion or criticism of Islam. And I fear that we still remain tentative and really prohibit ourselves from entering the House of Islam to explore it and really find out what's going on with it when we use euphemisms. And so this essentially is one of the takeaways I hear from Geert Wilders and Lars Hedegaard in Europe, discussions of Islam and what Islam is doing, what is Islam doing in the West to Western societies, not radical Islam, not Islamism. And it could be because they are actually more frontally up against it. They are under, Denmark is now under siege. The Netherlands is under siege. I mean, we are seeing much hotter battles there in their own streets and localities.
Including direct and mortal threats to both of the individuals you've just mentioned, Lars Hedegaard in Denmark and Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. Diana, obviously one piece of this, and it came up, I think, repeatedly in the course of the Defeat Jihad Summit, is a desire not to tar all Muslims with this program. And it does raise a set of thorny questions if, in fact, and I believe this to be true, and I think you do too, that the authorities of Islam, the people who are supposedly its definers as well as its leaders, are of a mind that it is Sharia that is Islam. And while there are lots of Muslims who may not subscribe to Sharia or want to live under it themselves or impose it on anybody else, they would not be, you know, the driving forces in the faith. So how do you think one defines the term so as to not implicate such numbers of them as there may be unduly or unnecessarily?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it's something that does spring to mind to many people who are good human beings. But I actually find the feelings of Muslims to be extraneous to the entire argument. I think it's time to put responsibility on individuals who follow Islam to account for themselves. But in terms of national security or protecting the Constitution or protecting our border and so on, it is irrelevant that some large number of Muslims do not take up arms and follow jihad, or not literal practitioners, do not shoot people at cafes having conversations about free speech, as we saw in Denmark recently. It is not really relevant to the discussion. The discussion is about this ideology, this legal system, this cultural force, this vehicle of conquest, as we have watched it over centuries, wreak havoc with civilizations across continents. It is really, I don't think it behooves us to protect Islam's reputation to save the feelings of Muslims who may or may not subscribe to it. I can't speak to what individuals think. I can only look at what the prescriptions are, what the rules are, what the history is, and what the impact is, and discuss that and try to warn people against developing demographics through mass Muslim immigration that will support these things.
Yeah, in fact, we just talked about that with Rosemary Jenks in terms of refugee resettlement programs that are, you know, part of, it would appear, the Al-Hijra sort of colonization agenda of these Sharia-adherent folks.
Well, I think we tend to be held hostage ourselves to fear of offending people. And what I discovered in American Betrayal, researching American Betrayal, was that this same impulse neutralized or stopped cold similar efforts to defend ourselves against communism. There was a tremendous impetus not to offend the Russians that became a means of appeasement, a means of capitulation back during the 1940s, during World War II, and thereafter, of course. This becomes a matter of pressure, of blackmail, in a sense, on good people to keep them from really discussing the actual problem, which is the ideology of communism, which seeks world domination, or the ideology of Islam that seeks world domination. And it's really not up to us to apologize for it.
I guess I just, on my own account anyway, I would say I'm less interested in not offending people, though one doesn't want to do that unnecessarily or without thought. But I, as I am trying to prevent people who are not with the enemy from being driven into their arms, and I have found in my own thinking about this that using as a sort of fault line between those communities, Sharia is helpful. But let me turn quickly to, in what's left of our time, Diana, the countering violent extremism agenda the administration is trotting out. There's been a lot of talk about it. Of course, in the run-up to the summit, people making much of the outreach efforts that the administration has made, notably in Boston and in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and in Los Angeles. Quickly, what are your thoughts on how this outreach is going and whether, in fact, it is simply a manifestation of the very problem you're talking about, that we call it violent extremism in the first place?
Oh, very much so. It's further layering on of euphemism. It's further turning the whole problem into one of police work, which I think is a very big impetus among elites across the political spectrum, across the globe, really. I think that it's another means of trying to protect Muslims from the rules and regulations and culture of their creed. I do think also that any moderate person who is driven into the arms of a terrorist organization or into a life of extremism, to use the word of the day, by honest discussions of Islam, by honest discussions of what Sharia is, what Islam does, is not on our side to begin with. And I don't think that there should be any fear of driving people into such a heinous creed simply by discussing it honestly. And I think that in a sense, it is a way of finding who is a moderate person and who is what I call, in Death of the Grown-Up, the hair-trigger moderate. Anything can set them off.
It's a very fair point, and it seems to me that you have done as good a job as anybody of thinking through how do we deal with such folks, how do we characterize them, and how do we develop and implement strategies against them. Notably, I want to commend you for the very, very critical, and I think properly so, critical analysis of the COIN strategy, the countering insurgency strategy that has guided the United States military through much of these years. That will be a subject for another day, though, I'm afraid. Thank you, Diana, for this day's conversation and for all you do at dianawest.net. Keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.